الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله. والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء وسيد المرسلين سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم محمد. والصلاة والسلام على أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين المنتجبين لا سيما مولانا وسيدي صاحب العصر والزمان روحي وأرواح العالمين له الفداء وأجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف ولعنة دائمة على أعدائهم ومنكر فضائلهم الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين. أما بعد، رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي. For the hastening of the return of our 12th Imam, Imam al-Hujjah, one salawat upon Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. This evening for the Thursday night, I want to continue in the theme that we began last week in terms of the philosophy and etiquette of the ziyarat in the Islamic teachings. And obviously, because we are going through this period of Muharram and Safar, and it's the time when people are obviously going for the ziyarat more often than other times of the year. Obviously, the day of Arba'een is coming up soon, where people will be making their way to Karbala in the millions. And so I wanted to take this opportunity to go over some of the philosophy and etiquette of ziyarat itself, whether we do it from home or whether we do it actually at the specific shrine. In our last discussion last week, we went over just a very brief introduction on this topic, looking at the introduction to ziyarat and some of its benefits. And just as a recap, in a few minutes, we talked about the fact that ziyarat is a concept which was rooted in Islamic theology, in Islamic history. And we mentioned the fact that Muslims of all spectrums, Muslims across the board, have always engaged in the act of visitation, of going to the graves of the prophets of Allah, of the imams, of the saints, of those who they deem to be having that level of proximity to Allah. We also talked about the fact that this concept of ziyarat, this word itself, is used within the Quran. However, it was used in a few different ways. We talked about the fact that in the Arabic language, one of the words to lie, to tell an untruth, comes from the same word as ziyarat. Because literally we said that ziyarat means to deflect away from something and go towards something else. And so when somebody tells a lie, they are deflecting away from the truth and going towards what is false. We also talked about the fact that in Surah Al-Kahf chapter 18, when Allah talks about Ashabul Kahf, them sleeping in the cave, the same word for them to turn back and forth is also the same word where we get the word ziyarat from, because it means also to move back and forth. And last but not least was this act of visitation, of going to the graveyard. And we mentioned how in Surah Al-Takathur, Allah says, Al-Hakmu Al-Takathur Hatta Zurtumul Maqabir. And we talked about the fact that this was even a pre-Islamic Arab custom. Although, obviously, their understanding of ziyarat is not what we were wanting to look at in our discussion, but they also engaged in a form of visitation to the graves. With that, I want to go today into lecture two, into some important ziyarats that we have within our tradition, and one or two lines from the ziyarat of Sayyid al-Shuhada, specifically for the day of Arba'een, but also a specific phrase that is repeated within the ziyarat that I found has a very direct relationship to even us in today's day and age. First off, what is the meaning of the ziyarat, the general understanding of it? We basically, in a nutshell, understand this visitation, again, whether it's here in our own center or at home, or if we make the journey thousands of kilometers away. This ziyarat text that we read, many of them are provided to us by the infallibles, by the imams of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim wassalam. We have a certain examples which are not from the imams, but at the end of the day, when I mentioned that a ziyarat is a way to greet the Prophet or the imams, there does not necessarily have to be a certain formula of how to greet them. But we say that a ziyarat, what we read, let's say, from Mafatihul Jinan or the apps on our smartphones, that these are all formal ways to greet the Prophet, his family, and the righteous believers. Again, I say formal because we have informal greetings as well, just like we have dua kumail, which is a formal way to speak to Allah in the form of a dua. We have informal when you and I just talk to Allah in our own language. So du'as can be formal and informal, and so can the ziyarat. But the ziyarats that we have, they are formal ways to not only greet the Prophet and his family and scholars and companions of the Prophet and his family, but they also become a way for us to learn more about our religion, the teachings of Islam, history, theology. A lot of these things are within the context of the ziyarat. And therefore, when you look at something like ziyarat of Jamia, for example, taught to us by the 10th Imam, it's not just greeting the Imam or one of the members of Ahlul Bayt, but in it actually he speaks about the theological definition of imamat. Right? What is an imam? Imam meaning one appointed by Allah. In that ziyarat, the Imam goes through an entire course of understanding Islamic theology. If we look at ziyarat Ashura, for example, that we were reciting in the month of Muharram in the early nights, it's not just about greeting Sayyid al-Shuhada, it's also about recollecting the tragedy of Karbala, speaking about certain individuals, personalities that were responsible for bringing forth that atrocity that happened on the 10th of Muharram. And so the ziyarat becomes, again, more than just a reading. It becomes something that we can study and reflect upon and actually begin to learn more about our religion. I want to introduce us just to a few of the common ones that we recite and the importance of where they come from. We have obviously Ziyarat al-Warith, which we traditionally recite on a Thursday night. This Ziyarat was taught to us by the sixth Imam, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, alayhi salatu wassalam. When a companion called Safwan Jamal comes to the sixth Imam in Medina, and he says to him that he wants to perform the visitation of Aba Abdullah, but he's not in Karbala. So he asks the sixth Imam, can you teach me something that I can greet your forefather Aba Abdullah from far away? And so the sixth Imam gives him the ziyarat of Warith. So this is directly taught to us by the sixth Imam. And again, it can be read either from afar, it can be read from, you know, near when you're in Karbala. But the point is that this comes to us from a divine infallible, from the divinely appointed sixth Imam. And again, when we look at it and we have, you know, the translation on screen when we recite it, we see that we address Sayyidul Shuhada as being an inheritor, because warith literally means inheritor. One who is a warith is somebody who inherits something from somebody else. And so we refer to him as the inheritor of Adam, of Noah, of Moses, of Abraham, of Jesus, of our beloved Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alihi wa sallam. And so we see that Sayyidul Shuhada is not just an individual, but rather he becomes the culmination of the message of all the previous prophets. If you want to look at the 124,000 prophets, their challenges, their struggles, what they went through, their adversaries. Basically, you look at the life of Sayyidul Shuhada because he is the inheritor of all of that. And also all of their, you know, the graces, whatever they have been given by Allah. So the sixth Imam gives this ziyarat. And again, it goes through not only the visitation in terms of greeting the Ahlul Bayt and Sayyidul Shuhada, but we learn a lot about the Ahlul Bayt. We learn a lot about Imam Hussein. For example, we recall the fact that he comes from a pure lineage, that his forefathers, all the way going up to Nabi Adam alayhi salam, that they were all from a pure heritage. There was no pollution in their bloodline. They come from that prophethood, from that tree of prophethood. We talk about the fact that the earth that Sayyidul Shuhada is buried in, that Allah purified that earth. Even though the blood was shed, that earth has become sacred. It has become a land which is sacrosanct, which as we know today, we can use for shafa'at, which we use to pray upon. And so all of these things again become within the context and the text of the ziyarat. It gives us a better appreciation for Imam Hussein, for his mission, and also for the status which the Imams of Ahlul Bayt think about him as being at. A second ziyarat that we also recite frequently is ziyarat of Ashura. And again, this is something which has come to us from the chain of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. There are differences whether it comes from the fifth Imam or the sixth Imam, But this is one that is traditionally recited only on the day of Ashura in most communities. Other centers will use this recitation, the ziyarat, and recite it every single night of the month of Muharram, for example. There's a lot to say about ziyarat Ashura because obviously it's a very charged ziyarat. There's a lot of words in there that people have found offensive, people have taken exception with. People are concerned when they recite the ziyarat because of the concept of the la'nat, which we're talking about in a separate series. And so sometimes people have, within our own Shia community, they've tried to downplay the importance or the relevance or the authenticity of ziyarat Ashura. Even today we have many so-called intellectuals within our community who speak from a possession, from a position of authority, and they claim that ziyarat Ashura is not a authenticated ziyarat. You'll probably see these sorts of articles, or people will talk about this because of these certain phrases that are used to condemn the people who were responsible for the tragedy of Karbala. Obviously, I don't want to go into a detailed analysis. There are many books available, even in English, which offer a commentary of ziyarat Ashura and will analyze the authenticity of it. But obviously, when we look at it, our scholars across the board, from the earliest times up until today, have done their research and they have come to the conclusion that there are no problems with this ziyarat. Yes, the tone in certain passages is very harsh, no doubt. But when you reflect on what happened on the day of Ashura, and again, when we correctly understand the meaning and the usage of la'nat, that it's not a foul word, it's not a curse word, it's not vulgarity, it is a du'a, literally it's a supplication that we're making, that Allah remove His mercy from certain individuals because of their own acts of iniquity, then you understand that this is and can be something which can be rationalized through the Quranic narrative, because the Quran speaks about this concept of Allah removing His mercy from certain individuals. A third ziyarat that we should be acquainted with is a ziyarat called the ziyarat of Nahiya al-Muqaddasa. This is actually, it's a very lengthy, it takes maybe 30 to 40 minutes to read it, to go over this ziyarat. But one of the interesting things about this ziyarat is that it was taught by the 12th Imam directly. He taught it to one of his four representatives. And when you actually read the ziyarat, it doesn't necessarily read like a traditional ziyarat. You know, when we read ziyarat waratha, we have greetings and salutations on Imam Hussein, and we have certain aspects where we greet him. But ziyarat an-nahiya is more a commentary of the day of Ashura. So whatever you hear on the minbar about the tragedy of Karbala and the day of Ashura, if you want to hear how the 12th Imam would have recited a majlis, to use our terminology, to describe the day of Ashura and the maqtal, the tragedy of Karbala, we should read Ziyarat of Nahiya, because literally it's the 12th Imam giving us commentary of what happened on the day of Ashura. And much of it is very explicit. He talks about many of the things that happened to Abu Abdullah, the attacks on him, you know, the eventual decapitation. He goes into a lot of graphic, vivid detail in the ziyarat. But that obviously gives us a better understanding of how the 12th Imam looks at that tragedy of Karbala. And again, when he goes into it, he explains many things that only somebody from the family of the Prophet, who has that vision and who has connection to the tragedy, would actually be able to explain. And so this becomes, again, another important mainstay within our tradition. If we want to, again, understand the history of Islam, the history of Karbala, the role of the companions, the role of the family members, the role of what happened to Sayyidul Shuhada, Ziyarat of Nahiya, again, becomes one of the most important. And even in here, I'll make a point that some people also have questioned the authority and the authenticity of this ziyarat, because there are certain passages which explain about the ladies of Ahlul Bayt, about how, for example, Lady Zainab perhaps, or some other women, came out of the tents with their hair disheveled and their hair showing. And so some people have questioned this authenticity, that how can it be that the women of the family of the Prophet would come out without their hijab on, with their hair showing? And again, our scholars have given, you know, possible options or possible understandings of what these passages mean. And so rather than, you know, discounting the entire ziyarat, they analyze those certain passages and come to a conclusion of what they could be speaking about and what the 12th Imam could be inferring about that day of Ashura. And the last and the fourth of the ziyarats that we should be acquainted with is the ziyarat of Arba'in, the actual text of this ziyarat. And this again was also taught by the sixth Imam, Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam, to Safwan Jamal. Again, Safwan comes to the Imam, it's nearing to the period of Arba'in, and he asks the sixth Imam that, I want to greet Abu Abdullah on this particular day. Because it was a tradition from the time of the early times, obviously after Karbala, when the family came back to leaving Sham back to Karbala, on the way back home to Medina, they stopped at Karbala. And so Jabir was there with the fourth Imam, the fifth Imam. So the entire tradition of being in Karbala on Arba'in was there from the earliest days of the tragedy of Karbala. And so Safwan asked the sixth Imam that, give me something that I can use to greet your grandfather on this day of Arba'in. And so this text of the Ziyarat of Arba'in was taught to Safwan. Now I want to look at just one or two very brief passages and we'll conclude tonight of this Ziyarat. One of the most commonly reused phrases in all of our ziyarat, whether it be the four that I've just spoke about or any other one, is this phrase, As-salamu alayka. Now we understand this to be a greeting, peace be upon you. It's a greeting that Allah uses in the Quran. Just right now in Surah Yasin, we read, Salamun qawlum min rabbir rahim. This peace, this word peace, is a word from your Lord. Allah tells us in the Quran that when the believers meet one another, you should say to one another, Salamun alaykum, that your Lord has, you know, written mercy upon himself. Allah uses this phrase and the concept of greeting one another with the phrase salam many times within the Quran. Unfortunately, however, somewhere down the Muslim history, we've taken this phrase of assalamu alaykum and we've made it into just a greeting. Like, you know, today when two non-Muslims will meet, they'll say, hi, how are you? How's it going? We've taken this phrase of assalamu alaykum and made it into just a traditional greeting of one another, removing it actually of the true essence of the words. Yes, it's only two words, salam and alaykum, but actually the meanings of these two words when combined are profound. If you, for example, look at the commentary written of Ziyarat Ashura by Sheikh Muhammad Khalfan, a two-volume commentary. Well, two volumes have been printed, many more volumes will come out. But he gives about 14 different meanings for this phrase, As-salamu alayka. 14. It's not just, hi, how are you, how are you doing, how's the weather, what's up? It's 14 minimal, and he probably is being conservative, but he lists and explains 14 different meanings of this phrase. And not only should we realize that this phrase has a meaning in the ziyarat context, but also within our day-to-day life. So I'll give you just three of these meanings and how they relate and how we should be using it within our own, you know, our own life, our own lifestyle. He says that As-Salam is one of the names of Allah. You know, we have this hadith, Allah has 99 names. One of them is As-Salam. So what we're actually saying when we say As-Salamu Alayka, for example, Ya Aba Abdullah, or when we greet one of our own family or friends, is we're asking for this salam, this serenity, this peace from Allah to be upon that individual. So when we ask Allah, when we recite the ziyarat of Waratha, As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah, for example, or As-salamu alayka ya Waratha Adama Safwatillah, we're asking Allah to put His peace, tranquility, serenity into that individual. Let that person be at ease within their life. Let that person be in a state of tranquility. It also means pure and complete submission by the person who's using this word to the other individual. So when I say As-salamu alayka ya Ali al-Murtada or ya Fatima al-Zahra, I'm saying that I am giving you my complete level of submission. I recognize you as an authority from Allah, and I am completely submitting myself to to your teachings, to your injunctions. That's another meaning of salam that we have to keep in our minds. And also it means safety and security from me to you. That when I say to somebody, salam alaikum, I'm not just saying, hi, how are you? How are you doing? I'm saying that whatever emanates from me at this point forward is going to be only safety and security. I'm not going to use vulgarities against you. I'm not going to be rude with you. I'm not going to be harsh with you. I'm not going to, you know, do anything which would compromise this level of security or safety I'm about to enter into with you. This becomes very important at a level of our personal interaction. Because when, again, unfortunately, as a Muslim community, we have forgotten these meanings of salam. So when I say salam to somebody, then I should realize that I'm entering into a pact with them, that you're going to be secure from me. I'm not going to harm you verbally. I'm not going to talk bad to your face. I'm not going to talk bad behind your back. I'm not going to use profanity when I speak to you. I'm going to respect you as a believer. Unfortunately, when this understanding of salam leaves our own psyche, we then begin to use it as a normal greeting like anything else. We're not realizing that we are giving a person our guarantee of safety. You know, it's like somebody would call somebody up on the phone and two Muslims are talking to one another and they'll start off, salam alaikum, hi, how are you? How are you doing? All of these things. And then rather than talk about things which are a part of daily conversation, rather than, you know, asking how they're doing, about, you know, if there's anything that can be helped, they begin to enter into discourse about backbiting. People begin to talk about one another on the phone. You've just said salam to somebody. You just greeted them with a word of peace from Allah. And now you're starting to backbite other individuals. You're beginning to talk about, you know, this person is doing this in the community. And did you know that this person is involved with that person? Did you know that this person is divorced and that person is going through marital issues? And this happens so much in so many communities that people get divorced and it happens. It's a reality of life. But the problem is not the divorce. The problem is the people in the community who have too much time on their hands. And so they'll call one another, salam, how are you? By the way, did you hear what happened? Oh, no, what happened? Oh, this person got divorced. This person did this, this person did that. Oh, really? And then you start to talk about it, but you just started with salam. You just guaranteed that person's safety and tranquility. You just guaranteed that person that you're going to respect them. And now you're engaged in backbiting. So where is the peace? Where is the salama that you just promised them? Right? You're talking about somebody else, not realizing that that's their business. Right? Don't worry about what other people are doing. You've got your own family to worry about. You've got your own kids maybe. Right? You don't want people to talk about your kids, so why are you talking about other people? But unfortunately, we have too much time on our hands. And I'm not going to say it's only the women. I'm not going to say it's only the men. Everybody's guilty of it. We all do this, unfortunately. Not all of us. I'm not talking about all of us in this room. I'm talking about all of us as a collective. We engage in this. We say salam, how are you? And then we go and talk about other people and their private lives and what they're doing. Really, who cares what people are doing in their private lives? If it's their private life, let them deal with it. Make dua for them. Make dua that Allah helps them, that Allah takes care of them, that Allah grants them, you know, their needs in this world. Rather than talking about people, you've just said salam, you've just entered into a contract of peace, and now you're stabbing them in the back, and you're stabbing that person in the back as well. Because that is what ghibat is. It's backbiting. It's gossiping about what other people are doing. And so we have to realize that salam should be a part of our lives. We just pay a lip service. Every Thursday night we point our finger towards Karbala. As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah. We do the whole ziyarat of waratha. And then we go to ghibat. We talk about other people. We insult other people. We gossip. We spread rumors. What was the benefit of greeting Aba Abdullah and sending our salutations to him when we're going to break every rule in the book? So we have to realize that salam has to play a role in our lives. And if we see our communities are dysfunctional, people don't talk to one another, people don't attend, people are indifferent to many issues, Maybe it's because we have lost that level of salamat. We don't have peace in our communities because we're not at peace with the Ahlul Bayt. We're not at peace with Allah. And when we're not at peace with Allah, then we can't be at peace with our own community. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. I'll mention two lines of the ziyarat and we'll conclude for tonight. This is from the ziyarat of Arba'in. Just two different portions of how we address the sixth imam, how he addressed Abu Abdullah. He says at one portion of the ziyarat that you, meaning Allah, have granted him, Imam Hussein, the legacy of all of the previous prophets. And you, Allah, have positioned him as a decisive argument, as a hujjah, along with his other successors, meaning the 12 imams, over all of mankind. So as I mentioned previously, that Sayyidul Shuhada, he is, as the sixth imam says, Mawarithul Anbiya. He's the inheritor of the legacies of all of the previous prophets. So we have to study, obviously, their missions, their legacies, one by one, to get to a level to understand who Imam Hussein is. But he is an inheritor of all of those struggles of the prophets of the past. And he is a hujjah. He is that proof of Allah that on the Day of Judgment, those who were there in Karbala, those 30,000 soldiers who were there to shed his blood, they can't come and say that they didn't know who he was, that they didn't know Allah. Because he made it clear on the day of Ashura who he was, why he was there, what his relationship was to Rasulullah. And so nobody will have an excuse, obviously, except those who have never heard about his mission, but those who know about Sayyidul Shuhada and the tragedy of Karbala, he becomes that hujjah, that proof of Allah against all of those who know about him and his mission. And I'll end with this one last line, which shows us the totality of the mission of Karbala, in which the sixth imam says that Imam Hussein sacrificed his innermost core. This word muhjata, in Arabic it really refers to not just the soul, the body of the person, but every single aspect of the life of the individual. So he sacrificed everything he had, as the sixth imam says, that he sacrificed his innermost core and life for you, for the sake of Allah, so that Imam Hussein may liberate the servants of Allah from the yoke of ignorance and from the bewilderment of misguidance. Because that really is what it was about. Karbala was not a political battle. It wasn't a mission for Imam Hussein to become the king, the caliph. It wasn't about personal authority. It was about him standing up to remove that yoke of ignorance, of complete unawareness. And we talked about that a few nights ago, how after the death of Rasulullah, 50 years after the passing of the Prophet, the Muslim community can get to such a level that they were ready, and they did kill not only the grandson of the Prophet, but all of the male members of his family. As Imam Hussein said on the day of Ashura, that you want to kill me and the elders, the older people of the family, go ahead. Maybe we're guilty of something, but what crime have the children committed? What were the children guilty of that they had to be killed also on the day of Ashura? And so indeed, when the sixth imam says that Imam Hussein gave his life so that the humanity could be removed from this lack, this level of ignorance and misguidedness that they had fallen into, indeed, we saw that present not only on the day of Ashura, but also well past the day of Ashura. And as I conclude, just one last word for tonight is when the family of Rasulullah had finally entered into Sham, as we know that they were made to go from Karbala to Kufa, from Kufa to Sham. They walked most of that way in the burning heat of the desert of the Arabian Peninsula, of the Arab regions. And eventually, when they finally reached the gates of Sham, when they finally reached the gates of Damascus, we're told that the cursed Yazid kept the family of Rasulullah for 3 days outside of the gates as they began to decorate and make the city look beautiful and get the people all stirred up for this celebration. The family of Rasulullah were kept at the gates of Syria for 3 days. Eventually, when the gates were finally opened and they began to walk through the bazaar of Sham, that same bazaar that many of us have walked into as we go to the shrine of Bibi Sakina, At one point, we're told that an old man from the people of Sham, a man who had been brainwashed by the Banu Umayyah, he comes to the fourth Imam Zainul Abidin, and he comes to the Imam and begins to insult him. He says to the fourth Imam, he says, "Praise be to Allah who defeated you and who granted Yazid an upper hand against you and your family." The Imam turns to this old man. He says, "Oh Sheikh," he says, "Oh old man, have you read the Quran?" This old man, he says, "Of course I've read the Quran. I'm a Muslim." The fourth Imam says, "Have you read this verse? قُلْ لَا أَسْأَلُكُمْ عَلَيْهِ أَجْرًا إِلَّا الْمَوَدَّةَ فِي الْقُرْبَى." That where Allah tells the Prophet to ask for no reward for his mission except for love of the family. The old man says, "Yes, I've read this verse." The fourth Imam says that that is us. We are the Qurba that the Prophet has been mentioning in this verse. The Imam then says, "Have you read this verse? وَآتِ ذِلْقُرْبَ حَقَّ." Give the family their rights. The old man says, "Yes, I've read this verse of the Quran." As the fourth Imam is standing at the gates of Sham, he says that this is us. We are the Qurba. We are the family of the Prophet. The Imam then asks the man, "Have you heard this verse of the Quran about the verse of Khums, that one-fifth is for Allah and the Messenger and the family?" Again, the old man says, "Yes, that I've read that verse as well." The Imam replies that we are the one whose rights are the Khums. Eventually, the man becomes embarrassed and ashamed that he has been insulting and cursing the fourth Imam, that this is from the family of Rasulullah. The man begins to cry, he begins to weep and ask forgiveness from the fourth Imam for his lack of understanding. The fourth Imam says, "If you turn to Allah, indeed Allah will forgive you. We have forgiven you and Allah will forgive you." We're told that this old man begins to sing the praises of the Ahlul Bayt. He begins to curse the Banu Umayyah right in the palace of Yazid. He begins to curse the Banu Umayyah and Yazid for the tragedy of Karbala. And at that point, one of the governors or one of the individuals orders that man to be killed. On that day, as the Ahlul Bayt are going into the Darbar of Yazid, this man is killed out of his love for the Ahlul Bayt and for the tragedy of Karbala. وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّمٌ قَلَبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ إِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. We ask Allah, as we continue in this month of Muharram, the month of tragedy, that Allah accept this act of worship from us tonight. We ask Allah to forgive us our sins and to keep us all on the path of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. And we ask Allah to hasten the return of our 12th Imam, Imam Al-Hujjah. رَبَّنَا تَقَبَّلْ مِنَّا إِنَّكَ أَنْتَ السَّمِيعُ الْعَلِيمُ. صَلُّوا عَلَى مُحَمَّدٍ وَآلِ مُحَمَّدٍ.